National interest this week is staying with the COVID tragedy and the challenges it's causing for the Indian state and the state of the government in India and the quality of its response to this big challenge. But before I go there, I will tell you thank you very much. I had told you a couple of weeks back that we were starting a new feature for our subscribers called Your Turn, where our subscribers get an exclusive platform to write their opinions. I am really gratified, as are my colleagues, with the response we've got. The first edition of Your Turn is published today. Please see how these opinions have come out. We will improve the presentation, etc., as we go along. But please keep your views coming in. And also, when you send your views, particularly as you write them like an article, I told you this is your chance to destroy the opinion industry only for our subscribers. Please also send us a picture of yours wherever possible. We will use your pictures as well. And if you have any social media handles, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, please tell us those so we can also tag you, and we'll also share those on social media. Every week, I will share the three that I consider the most important or most interesting on my Twitter and Facebook handles as well. So thank you very much for writing it. Now, back to National Interest. National Interest this week examines what kind of a situation we have in India, what kind of a government do we have in India, what kind of a state do we have in India. So this is sparked by the latest India Today cover story. On the cover, India Today calls India a failed state because of the way the entire COVID situation has gone out of control. It doesn't look like anybody's in control. It looks like every person for themselves, because everybody is now on social media asking for help or giving each other help. So is India a failed state? Certainly. News magazine India Today, which was my alma mater for 12 years between 1983 and 95, that thinks so, but I would humbly disagree. We are not a failed state yet. Because if we were a failed state, then this publication would not have said so on its cover, and I wouldn't be writing this article or speaking about this on camera as I'm doing right now. If India was a failed state already, we might not have known how badly we were failing. As long as the nation's own media, civil society, even individual citizens are free to bring the bad news to all, hold the mirror to the most powerful ruler in our country in at least four decades, if not longer, we are not a failed state yet. But we are not a perfect state. So what are we then? I might then opt for a more apt description: a flailing state, writhing in pain, tossing about in desperation, helplessness, confused, chaotic, poorly led, on the verge of a disaster, but still looking for answers. So not failed, because it is still looking for answers and debating as we do right now. Flailing state, therefore, is a better characterization of India Today, not the magazine, India Today. And it is such a pity that I didn't invent this expression. This expression was invented by economist Lant Pritchett, who is currently research director at the Blavatnik School of Government at University of Oxford. And this expression he used in his much-quoted 2009 paper at Harvard Kennedy School, provocatively titled, "Is India a Flailing State? Detours on the Four-Lane Highway to Modernization." Now, important point is, he said this in 2009, when UPA was at its peak, it had got re-elected, and it had given us a red-hot epoch of growth. So at that point, he pointed out that, look, while India is growing and India is on this highway to modernization, India will suffer because of its weak state capacity. Today, if you see, is that state capacity any better? In fact, if there's one thing this COVID crisis has exposed, it is India's really doddering state capacity in every area of delivery, particularly in a crisis, in a big national crisis. Now, take you back to 2009. After 2009, the second term of UPA was quite chaotic. It was confused. The quality of governance slid steeply. The government was paralyzed with contradictions and indecision. As the state flailed even harder, Narendra Modi rose to seize the moment and promised to change it. It was around 2009-10 that he began to announce his arrival as a national leader. Minimum government, maximum governance. That was his promise, and people believed him. and of an uncertain, dithering state, people thought, let us now go to a more decisive one. Through 7 years of economic stall, though, under Narendra Modi, his voters have kept the faith in him. Although the economy has not done well, it has stalled, and now lately, for the past 3 years, it's been declining. But people still kept the faith in him until now, when this virus came back and exposed the reality that after 7 years under Modi, India is still in an unprecedentedly dysfunctional, worse, flailing state. And this helplessness is what's coming out, and I'm quite sure has also reflected in the results in West Bengal and UP Panchayat elections. This is also a vote against lack of quality governance. Now the state, our state, quote unquote, the top leadership, its institutions, including the bureaucracy, the scientific establishment are all either missing in action or scurrying about to cover up or somehow airbrush the image, not change the reality. So you say things like, oh, we have the largest number of vaccinations or second largest. But you don't say that only 3% of my population is vaccinated twice and just about 10% or 11% is vaccinated even once. You don't say that. So that is called airbrushing. Or you say, I have tested 30 crore people, which is a record, but at the same time, you don't admit that we are so short of RT-PCR testing now that ICMR has actually issued guidelines that once a person tests positive, there is no need. In fact, the labs are no longer allowed to test that person a second time because RT-PCR tests are in short supply. So this also entails the risk that somebody who might think I'm okay, but is still shedding the virus, could be going around mixing with the community. But this is being done because nobody wants to admit public that we are short of testing kits. Now, every leader has their key brand propositions. Modi's, besides Hindutva and hard nationalism, included administrative ability, execution, and efficient delivery of welfare, infrastructure building. Now, we've seen some of that in the past 7 years, to be fair. We've seen very efficient delivery of welfare to the very poor. Through using Jam Trinity, using Aadhaar, using technology, banking channel, stuff like that. That's been quite efficient, and that also resulted in his higher numbers in the 2019 elections despite poor economic growth. Second, we have seen the construction of hard infrastructures, highways, ports, airports, etc. That definitely has come up. But the foundations of basic governance were not strengthened. If anything, it looks like they've been weakened because many institutions are weakened. And when we say institutions are weakened, we are not necessarily talking about judiciary, media, election commission. We are talking about the central institutions of governance, not even oversight. And what is the most important central institution of governance? It is the cabinet system. Because in a normal cabinet system, by this time, the best, the most efficient and effective, the most towering members of the cabinet would have been handed over the responsibility of this crisis response, because this is a national emergency. That's not being done right now. And at the same time, those ministers who may have failed on the job would have been shown the door. In such a grave national crisis, you don't put your politics or your personal likes and dislikes ahead of your large citizenry's, large population's life and death issues. That's what India faces right now. Now, we'll give you some examples from our own political history of when it was done. So I know that supporters of Narendra Modi and BJP, who are in much larger numbers now than supporters of any other leader in India at this point, they get triggered if you mention Jawaharlal Nehru. But let's mention Jawaharlal Nehru at least in a moment of defeat. In 1962, he lost the war to the Chinese. What did he do? He accepted the fact that he had lost the war. He fired his defense minister, V.K. Krishna Menon, and brought in Y.B. Chavan with his strongman Maratha reputation, or Maratha strongman reputation. In no time, Y.B. Chavan got down to the job. Soon enough, he launched Indian Armed Forces' first five-year plan for modernization, and we saw the results already in the 1965 war. Similarly, Lal Bahadur Shastri inherited from Jawaharlal Nehru one terrible national humiliation and crisis. That was food shortages, starvation, famines, dependence on American wheat imports, lots of other food imports and foreign aid. So what did he do? He, for this agriculture minister, found C. Subramanian, who was a surprise, but he was somebody who was very modern, forward-looking, not involved in petty politics, not so concerned about winning elections, playing this caste versus that caste in the Hindi heartland. So he focused on agriculture. Indira Gandhi, when she took over from Shastri, allowed Subramanian to continue. By 1969, we saw the Green Revolution. Then I may jump 4 decades. You jump 4 decades, you come to 2008, 26/11. Again, a big humiliation for India when those terrorists came and they had a free run in Mumbai, shooting up the top brass of Mumbai police, killing people in many key places, 2 big hotels, so on and so forth. And that is when our Home Minister Shivraj Patil was found wanting in the job. Also, he made statements, made appearances that did not convince people, that actually irritated people and did not at all add to their sense of security. So what did Manmohan Singh do? He removed him because he had failed on the job and he replaced him with P. Chidambaram. The fact is that institutions like NIA, National Investigating Agency, and NTRO, National Technical Resource Organization, these institutions were set up by him as Home Minister, and today the BJP lays such store by them. So once again, this is an example of when you accept a reality, you can fix it. I jumped 4 decades, but I can take you back again to 1991. Look at Narasimha Rao. He found that when he took over, India's economy was close to bankruptcy. India was on the verge of a balance of payments crisis. Chandrasekhar had already mortgaged India's gold. The gold had been flown in by Air India aircraft. At that point, what did Narasimha Rao do? Horses for courses. He went out of politics and he found Manmohan Singh to be his finance minister and also allowed him the space to function, take decisions and to fix that economy. So all these situations, the leader of the day accepted that something was wrong, that it wasn't going to be possible for him to fix it, and found somebody with the ability to do so. So we are not making a call to fire this minister or hire that, because personalities in such big national crises don't matter, issues matter. So let's list the crucial ones that made these hard decisions that I just listed for you possible. And number one, that there was an honest acceptance that something had gone wrong. Unless you accept failure, you cannot address it. Unless you accept the diagnosis of a disease that one of us might have got, we cannot start treating it. So accepting the reality is the first step. Number two, there was no compulsion to ring fence the top leader or leadership. 1962, everybody blamed Jawaharlal Nehru, even people in the Congress party at that point. Number three, there was no desperation to give all the credit to one leader for everything, because that requires a constant declaration of victory. Because if you keep on giving credit for everything to one leader, then how do you protect that leader from blame when things go wrong? That is a contradictory situation. Because if you have to give all the credit to one leader, you then require a constant declaration of victory, which means you cannot accept the reality of a setback. At each of these junctures, there wasn't an almighty cult of sycophancy. Now, we know that Indian politics has seen a lot of phases of sycophancy. There was D.K. Barua, Indira's India phase. In Rajiv Gandhi's time also, there were Kalpanath Rai, K.K. Tiwari. So all those phases were there. But we did not then have ministers writing multiple tweets a day, hailing the Prime Minister for every aircraft landing and disgorging foreign aid. We may call it friendship. And presuming that their job was done, whereas this aid was only made necessary because of their failure with their own portfolios. The way they are getting away and the way the Prime Minister has retreated into some kind of a silence is adding to this disaster. It's a government in denial. Its defense ranges from our average per million deaths are still much lower than Britain or US, or that this is an awful foreign variant that nobody knew anything about, or that look at the size of our population, we are still vaccinating more than any other country in the world, except maybe the US, and we'll soon catch up with the US. One call from the PM and see, help is landing from all over the world. One nudge from the PM and see how Biden has lifted IPRs on the vaccines, etc. Now the latest is that this wave is now plateauing and the crisis will be over soon. This, I am afraid, is a suspension of collective disbelief, and it's going to be dangerous. It's time now for some humility. Only that can lead to a larger national conciliation and a unity of purpose. What kind of humility? I'm afraid I will have to invoke Nehru again, although this time there will be a probable consolation for those who don't like Nehru. I take you back to the book Freedom at Midnight, which many of you would have read, by Dominic Lapierre and Larry Collins. And I am also sharing with you the relevant pages of the book with you, both as a link with the description, but also on the screen. Now, in the book, the document an event when Punjab was burning with partition riots and the fires reached Delhi, it seems that Nehru went to Mountbatten, who was the viceroy, and said, look, we can't handle this. We were not trained in governance. While you were governing the country, you were either agitating or protesting. We know that. We never learned to govern, or we were spending time in your jail. So when did we have the time to learn to govern? You come and help us. So you set up a special committee, a cabinet committee, which you head, and you help us get over this crisis. Mountbatten tried to say that, how can you do it? You've just become independent. But Nehru, and there was one more leader with him, they said, look, but we understand that we are not able to handle this. So the authors quote that as an example of large-heartedness and humility, an act of statesmanship. So Mountbatten did actually constitute an emergency council, which he headed in that period of crisis. Now this book then drew much protest from Congress and demands to ban it. But the authors noted this as an act of large-heartedness. Now we are not suggesting certainly that Modi do any such thing, that he go to somebody and say, can you run the government in my place? No, no such thing. We are not delusional. We are not saying any such thing. I'm not nuts. But he needs to reach out to talent within his own party. He has to accept that this crew has failed so far and even elsewhere. And he has to take the opposition into confidence, call for maybe a cessation of hostilities for now, build a joint federal front of the center and the states, stop this name calling between them, and douse this fire. For all this, first we need an acceptance of the enormity of the crisis, if not failure. It will need that one attribute that we haven't seen in his governance so far, that is called humility. It will not bring about a dramatic solution. A flailing state will not suddenly become a solid performing state, because our problems are deeply structural. I accept that terrible things can stuff large, complex, poor, populous nations. But it is how you respond to these crises that distinguishes a politician from a leader. And I promised you a compensation. So in my postscript, I tell you that who was the leader who accompanied Jawaharlal Nehru when he went to Mountbatten to ask if he could help them run the government in India in that time of partition crisis and that time of bloodletting? It was none else than Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel.